Welcome, dear hunters, managers, and enthusiasts. This is Deer University, the podcast of the Mississippi State University Deer Lab. My name is Bronson Strickland.
And I'm Steve Damaris. Bronson and I are professors of wildlife management and co-directors of the MSU Deer Lab. Together, we've researched deer across the United States for more than 40 years. In our podcasts, we explain the why and how of deer management based on science, whether it's research we've conducted or explaining research done elsewhere. We'll offer you a college course in the science of deer management.
But don't let Steve scare you. This isn't going to be a review of calculus or chemistry. Instead, we take results of research, reduce it to what's important, and explain how you can apply research to management. So join us for this episode of Deer University. Today, we have a really important topic to discuss. One about probably a topic that's going to impact anyone that thinks about selective harvest or culling and impacting genetics, and that is which bucks are doing the breeding. That is a really, really important topic in terms of if any progress were to be made managing for genetics, it's going to depend on which sires or which bucks are doing the breeding and what characteristics they have. The thing about it, Steve, is that for the longest time, we had this belief of which bucks were doing the breeding, and it was these very few old dominant bucks. Everything was left up to them. They were the top dogs. They had the exclusive breeding rights of all the does as they would come into estrus. And Steve, over the years, research at the MSU Deer Lab, you have more or less, you and students you've cooperated with, have shown that is just not accurate.
That's right. You know, the old research, a lot of it was done in based on visual observation, and literally early researchers back in the 70s and 80s, they would put up a bird nest up in the top of a telephone pole out in South Texas brush country and literally visually observe bucks and does interacting during the breeding season. And several of the early works were done that way, and they concluded that mature dominant bucks were monopolizing does and doing the breeding, and that's what led to this generally accepted theory about who's doing the breeding. But as we like to say, who's your daddy? We're going to try to prove it with DNA. Because back in the early 2000s, the DNA technology that we now have come to accept as part of any of the TV shows we watch, the law enforcement, they get a little speck of blood, they run DNA.
The CSI, yeah, and all those. Yeah.
Well, those kinds of technology became available to wildlife researchers. And, you know, the problem with the early work that was based on visual observations, it was kind of like, you know, that old Charlie Rich song that made famous by Kenny Rogers, you know, and I'm not going to sing it because I've heard your opinion of my singing, but, you know, no one knows what goes on behind closed doors. And much of the breeding activity of bucks and does goes on behind closed doors. They are designed not to be seen by potential predators. A lot of their activity is at night in the dark. No observations visually in the dark in the 70s and 80s. And you just don't see everything that goes on. And so using the DNA technology, we're able to evaluate the offspring genetically and tie them back to specific bucks. And so really, you know, that work was led in the early 2000s by one of my fine doctoral candidates, Randy DeYoung, Dr. Randy DeYoung, who's now at Texas A&M Kingsville. And we started out doing some captive breeding work here at the Deer Lab, where we really, it was one of these cool, amazing things that you stumble on every once in a while. We didn't really expect to document it. We were looking at dominance hierarchy of bucks and who did the breeding. And we were the first to ever document something called multiple paternity, which means in a set of twins, which is normal for whitetail, in a set of twins, they're separate eggs ovulated by the female, and so they could, in theory, be fertilized by different sperm. Well, each one will be fertilized by a different sperm. And if there's multiple fathers that have bred, or you know, multiple bucks that have bred a doe, she could actually be conceive fawns from different fathers. And we showed in our pens that 25% of twins were actually conceived by multiple fathers.
Most people, as we were amazed when at that discovery years ago, and whenever we tell that to people now, people are amazed. It's just hard to comprehend because we have this image in our mind, I think, that there's that, and the tending bond strategy.
Yep.
There's that doe in estrus, there's that buck that's in pursuit, and there's that particular buck that's going to court and dominate, and but it's just not the case. And Steve, we think of it this way too, is that with twins, you document it at 25% of the time. You don't know with singletons, there could be multiple sires as well. It's just that only because there's only a single fawn was born, you can't, there's no way to test how many times
she was bred.
She was bred by a different sire as well. So just with the twin litters, that was documented.
Yeah.
But multiple breeding could be happening with those singleton mothers as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we thought initially, well, this was in a 1 to 2 acre pens, research pens. Maybe it's not consistent in the wild. Maybe it's just a phenomenon of our research pens. And Randy went on and looked, well, we had several populations that Randy used for his dissertation. And then he did some more research once he started in South Texas. And basically on, I think, somewhere around 6 wild populations, it still comes out to about 25% of twins are from multiple fathers. So 1 in 4 sets of twins are conceived by different fathers.
So Steve, this, and we're not going to get into this because this is a whole nother episode some other time, but so what's going on here? Is a particular buck, has he copulated? Has he, you know, he has tended and bred? And then do you think he loses interest? Do you think he might go, his senses may think that, oh, there's another doe in estrus? He's got to get back on the search again. Do you think it's possible to have a, just coincidentally, it could be a younger buck, may have started the courtship and began breeding this doe, and then an older and possibly more dominant buck comes to the game late.
Yeah.
And so he breeds her later. So there's a lot of different scenarios.
Absolutely. And in fact, one day we were out trying to dart some deer in one of the pens. And the way we do that, you know, we push the deer down to a corner and somebody's up in a blind in a tree and they shoot the dart at the deer that we want to sedate. And coincidentally, that day, one of the does was in estrus because the dominant buck in that pen, we had 3 bucks in the pen with, you know, about 12 does, and the dominant buck was tending her hard and keeping the other bucks away from her. Well, that disrupted our ability to push the deer down into a corner because that buck wouldn't let the other bucks anywhere near the doe, and so it was just a mess.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow in the process, the dominant older buck, I think he was like a 3-year-old buck, and we had a 2-year-old and a 1-year-old buck in that pen. And somehow the 2 and the 3-year-old buck started sparring and fighting, chasing each other around. And the yearling buck slipped up and bred the doe, like just like that.
Opportunistic.
The sneaky strategy. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that happens. A dominant buck is challenged by another closely ranked buck for access or control of the doe, and that leaves her unprotected.
Mm-hmm.
I remember years ago doing a spotlight count on a ranch in Texas when we worked out there, and just driving down the road seeing a buck, and driving down a little bit further and seeing another buck, and then another buck. And then I thought, wait a minute, there's a doe standing right next to that buck. And then going past the buck and the doe, there's another buck and another buck. And there were like seven bucks within a quarter mile of this doe that was clearly in estrus. She had all these bucks around her. And this was a property that was well managed for trophy management. They had an older age class, a lot of bucks, equal sex ratio. And so there were plenty of bucks around interested in this doe. So if that one dominant buck that was in control of, you know, was tending her, got in a fight, there were six other bucks ready to slip up.
Ready to take his place.
Yeah. So okay. I think that greatly explains it.
That's a great segue there, Steve, because when you mentioned one of those landmark studies, heck, 3, 4, 5, I can't remember now, decades ago, but when we first started looking at this breeding behavior, and you mentioned people climbing up these telephone poles like they were getting into a bird nest, as someone who spent time on that property, that refuge you're referring to that climbed up those poles, I know the property and the population you're referring to, that's an unhunted population.
Yeah.
So that was a population in southern Texas. It was a big wildlife refuge that was unhunted. That's very, very important for some of the material we want to discuss now, because when that observer or group of observers climbed the pole and looked at who was doing the breeding, they concluded that a majority, if not all of it, was older slash dominant bucks, because there was a lot of older slash dominant bucks in that population. Mm-hmm. Because it was unhunted.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But what you've shown, and I'm going to give you the floor here to talk about this a little bit more, who's doing the breeding, the age of the buck doing the breeding, all depends on the age structure of the population.
Yeah. Yeah. We've done some research here at the Deer Lab looking at breeding success of individual bucks. And Randy, again, when he went to South Texas, did some further work. And he showed that on properties that were managed for trophy production with older age structure, where greater than 50% of the bucks are 3 years of age or older, an older age class, hunted but not heavily hunted, he collected 57 sets of litters from does that had been bred. So using those 57 litters that were sired by a single buck, not counting any of the multiple paternities, 85% of the successful bucks only sired one litter, 15% sired two litters, and only 5% sired three or four litters. And so what that's telling us, it's not we can't say that 85% of the bucks only bred one doe, because he didn't sample the entire population of does. But that data clearly indicates that a lot of individual bucks are doing the breeding.
The flip side to say that would, there are very few bucks that are having multiple breeding events, and there don't appear to be any bucks that, quote, monopolize all the breeding opportunities.
That's right.
And I'm going back to where we started with selective harvest and culling, and you're assuming that there's this one big buck in the population, and he's going to do all the breeding if you let him go. The data clearly show that's not the case.
That's right. And I've had multiple landowners over the years tell me, that they had seen a really nice buck and they didn't want to shoot him because he wanted him to be the brood buck for the population.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Not a good decision. If you want to protect a buck because he hasn't reached full maturity yet,
by all means.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely do it. But don't justify it based on I want him to breed.
Yeah. Like he's going to disproportionately, because of his antler size, mind you.
Yeah.
He's going to disproportionately breed more than other bucks, because even they may weigh more, but just because then, and that we tend to think that.
Yeah.
If they have larger antlers, they're probably going to be breeding more.
Yeah.
Again, not the case. So, Steve, you learned that there's a lot of bucks doing the breeding.
That's right.
And so a lot of bucks are doing a little bit of breeding. Some bucks are doing a little bit more, but there's certainly not one or two particular bucks monopolizing. But because you study different populations, were there any generalities or patterns that you found?
The main part of Randy's dissertation work was looking at reproductive success in three different populations. One here in Mississippi was a public hunting area that basically had no restrictions other than state legal, and hunters flocked to it because it was, 50,000 acres of public land, and they could shoot the first legal buck that they saw, and they did. There was what we would call a male-biased harvest at that property. So at the beginning of the hunting season, the sex ratio was unbalanced. It was about a buck to 3.5 does. And because of the gun season being prior to the breeding season, there was a heavy harvest of bucks. So by the time the breeding season came around, the sex ratio was way out of whack. It was a buck per 7 or 8 does. And the bucks that were present, there just weren't that many of them. And it was spread among age classes, but, there was just a really unbalanced sex ratio. And then we had a second population that was really managed as a quality deer management program. Yearlings and two-year-olds were generally protected, and 3 years of age and older were available for harvest. And they had a relatively balanced sex ratio of about 1 buck to 1.5 does. And then the third population we looked at was in, the second one was in Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. And it was part of the Noble Foundation properties, and our old friend Ken G, that's where he ran that property as a research biologist. And then the third property was a South Texas trophy management, large acreage trophy management property. And their approach was, if it's not mature, we don't shoot it. So bucks were living to 6, 7, 8 years of age before they were being shot. So there was a preponderance of older age class bucks and a relatively balanced sex ratio. So we got to look at breeding success by age class in three different populations, one with a really young population of bucks and a really skewed or unbalanced sex ratio, one with a kind of a middle-aged buck population, balanced sex ratio, and then the third property was a much older-aged buck population with a relatively balanced sex ratio. Now, what we learned in the public hunted area, where there was a lot of does and not much age structure in the bucks, yearling bucks did almost a third of the breeding. 2-year-old bucks did about half of the breeding. And then the last third was done by 3.5 and older.
What few there were
in
that population.
Yeah, yep. And that's basically a numbers game.
Right, right. So what you're showing here, Steve, is buck age structure, of course, is important. But then the sex ratio plays an important part as well. And so it's numerical, meaning that when there aren't enough older bucks in the population, and then simultaneously you have an uneven sex ratio, and then on top of that, at the peak of breeding season, there's more does coming into estrus at any given time that those few older bucks can tend to. And so the younger the age structure and the greater the sex ratio is, or the more skewed it is, the more you're going to see a relationship with younger age bucks doing the breeding.
That's right. That's right. But what's really interesting is in the quality deer management property and the trophy management property, the 1-year-old and 2-year-old bucks consistently did about 30% of the breeding. So even where there were middle-aged bucks, a good number of 3.5-year-old bucks, and then even a great number of 5 and 6 and 7-year-old bucks, 30% of the breeding was done by yearlings and two-year-olds.
All right, Steve, so there's going to be some people have a problem with that. So here you have this population that is managed, it's managed exactly the way you would want it if you were managing for older age bucks and for antler, you know, size, for that type of population. So about half of your population is mature.
Yes.
Some of those ranches we've worked on, about half of the bucks you see are mature, okay? And then you also have an even age structure. So in that context, how in the world can 30% of the breeding be taking place by yearling bucks?
Sneaky, and you know, the multiple dominant or multiple older bucks busy fighting each other for access to the doe, and that's when sneaky 1 or 2 year old buck sneaks in,
mm-hmm.
does his business. Because at the heat of estrus, the female doesn't have a preference in terms of, well, she doesn't have a, she's going to be bred by the buck that's with her. Now, I don't want to give away too much cool stuff that we'll talk about in another podcast, but we've got some really exciting studies wrapping up here about female preferences during the breeding mm-hmm. period, but we'll cover that another day.
Okay. Let's move on then, Steve, to we've covered general trends. We've covered the impact of the population characteristics, age
yeah.
structure, mm-hmm. sex ratio, and how that affects. Instead of talking about populations and age classes, were there any patterns on the buck himself? Was there any pattern that made, when you could look at that buck, or made him more than likely to be a breeder versus a non-breeder, or breed more often than not?
Yeah, so like comparing you and me physically, maybe there's some differences why you're more of a dominant breeder than I am. Is that what you're getting at?
Well, I'm married.
Yeah.
So that helps.
Okay. Yeah. So seriously, though, we looked at antler size. And we found no clear indication of antler size being related to successful breeding. And Randy, in some more of his subsequent work in South Texas, he's looked at populations of bucks and their antler size of successful breeders versus antler size of the average buck in the population. And the successful breeders' average antler size is identical to the average antler size of the population. So that within the age class,
mm-hmm.
the successful yearling bucks have average antler size for yearling bucks in the population. The successful two-year-old bucks, their average antler size is identical to the average two-year-old buck in the population. The three-year-old bucks, again, identical to the average three-year-old in the population. So antler size is not driving this at all.
So what is?
Well, body size has a big say in it. Some of our work our penned work, body mass explains 60% of the breeding success when antlers were removed. And we remove our antler, the buck's antlers for safety purposes for the bucks, safety purposes for the researchers, and to keep the research pens from being destroyed. But bigger bodies allowed control of access to females, generally. Bigger bodies does have a big say, 60% of the variation.
So what about the 40%?
40%, that's probably comes down to attitude. Natural aggressiveness.
Mm-hmm.
Natural aggressiveness. Some bucks are just aggressive when it comes to that.
Some bucks are fighters.
Some bucks are fighters. Some,
they have the attitude. They're just looking for trouble. I mean, we've seen it. This exact same age class of buck. Very similar body size of buck. And some of them are just laid back and chilled out. And some of them want to tear you apart.
Yeah.
Every time you get near them.
Yep. Yeah. And in Randy's dissertation work, we looked at patterns of successful breeders, and there were really two categories of breeders, and I made these categories up, the names. One is the flash-in-the-pan approach. And so that kind of buck were successful because they were really aggressive and worked really hard at access to breed does. But they only bred for a couple of years. And they produced their fawns and then left the breeding population. And just to clarify, that population study was about a 10-year study. So we looked at long-term breeding success. So these flash-in-the-pan bucks were relatively successful, but only for 1 or 2 years, and then they burned out. Mm-hmm. Then the other category of successful breeder is the what I would call the slow but steady, or the good dancers, mm-hmm. if we could put it into a human context. You know, they didn't do a lot of breeding in any given year, and they might not have bred every year, but they were involved in the breeding over a long-term period, their entire life, pretty much. They may have been sneaky as a yearling, came on as a two-year-old, you know, just kind of hung around and waited for their chance, produced fawns multiple times over their lifespan. They were slow but steady.
Yeah.
So you got the hare and the tortoise, mm-hmm. and both can finish the race and both be successful strategies for contributing your genes to the population.
So whether you realize it or not, Steve, that was a very, very important concept in wildlife biology. Since we're doing Deer University here, we may as well talk about our college course here.
Sure.
That is, if you want to think like a deer, that is the single most important attribute for an animal to worry about, is what you just described was lifetime reproductive success. Lifetime reproductive success is the combination of how many years you live and how many times you're breeding. And so you can live a short number of years and breed a lot, or live a long number of years and breed infrequently, but you may end up with, you know, I sired, or this buck sired 20 fawns over its life, or 10 fawns over its life. And so Mother Nature, yeah, does have very different strategies of ways that some bucks may accomplish lifetime reproductive success differently.
That's right.
Some did it slow and steady and live a long time, and others were the flash in the pan, fighting, aggressive. We also know that being a big fighter and being aggressive, it takes a toll on your survivability.
Sure does.
You burn out quicker. So, really good lesson there. So, Steve, what does this all mean for management?
Well, we've got a couple of take-home points to emphasize. One is that if you see a large antlered buck on your property and he's reached the age class that you're managing for, don't protect him so that he can be your breed buck for another year, because he may or may not even contribute to the breeding population or breeding success that year. If he reaches your physical goal for harvest, go ahead and harvest him. If he hasn't reached the maturity level that you're managing for, whatever that happens to be, then go ahead and give him another year or 2 years or whatever. But don't make a harvest decision based on the idea that he's going to contribute his genes to the population.
Because the MSU Deer Lab research has demonstrated over and over again that just because the buck has above average antlers does not in any way, shape, or form mean he's going to breed an above average number of times.
Absolutely,
that's correct. I want to make that very, very clear. Just because they're above average in their phenotype or they look really good, they may not breed at all. That buck may be one of these that only has one successful breeding event a year. So yeah, go ahead and harvest that buck, but do it for the right reason. Or protect that buck, but protect it for the right reason.
Yes.
Not the illusion that you're improving the genetic makeup, mm-hmm. or the gene pool by letting him walk.
Yeah. And then the second point that we want our listeners to take home from this is that there are a lot of different bucks involved in the breeding process within a population. If you have a population that, you know, consists of, say, 30 bucks on your property, well, 20 of them may be involved in the breeding in a given year. So if you're going to have that much variation in who's your daddy in a deer population, the selection of certain kinds of bucks for protection or for removal isn't going to have any impact on the genetic characteristics of the population of deer, because there are so many that are doing the breeding regardless of what we're doing as hunters. It's almost idiot-proof or mistake-proof, their breeding strategy. You can't mess it up too bad, but you also can't improve it too much from a genetic standpoint.
That is, Steve, that's a really important point. And that's a topic that you and I have worked on for years and years and years. And you and I think it's fascinating because it has such a big impact. And that is, so these biological characteristics and ecological relationships you just described, and how they make selective harvest feasible or infeasible, depending on what you're trying to do.
Yes.
And so now I'm getting really excited about, you know what we need to record next?
Selective harvest.
When and when not to conduct selective harvest. When can you make progress? When is it absolute folly? And so why don't we do that next?
Great idea.
We're glad you joined us today and hope you learned something valuable about deer management. If you have questions about this podcast or a question about a topic we haven't discussed, please log on to msudeerlab.com, click on the Deer University tab, and send us your questions. We'll get to them as soon as possible. In closing, we want to thank our employers, the Mississippi State University Extension Service and the Forest and Wildlife Research Center. We also want to thank the St. John and Dudley Hutchinson families for their endowments that support deer research and education.